Discussions of key tree species in our part of the world tend to focus on the rock stars of the forest, the Douglas fir and the ponderosa pine. But it takes more than two trees to make a forest and an entire forest ecosystem. Our first guests today are focused on whitebark pines. In fact, they're spending this weekend in Ashland to attend the Whitebark Pine Ecosystem Foundation's annual Science and Management Workshop. They can tell us why whitebark pines are so important and why concern is so high. Our three guests are Diana Tombach, who is the director of the Whitebark Pine Ecosystem Foundation. Welcome, Diana.
I'm pleased to be here and talk about whitebark pine.
We also have with us Kristen Chadwick, who is a plant pathologist with the U.S. Forest Service working up in the Mount Hood area. Welcome, Kristen.
Good morning.
And we also have with us Jennifer Beck from Crater Lake National Park. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Since I made the reference already, did the snow have much of an effect on fires up near Crater Lake?
I think it helped significantly with control efforts.
Okay, good to hear about that. So let's go to you, Diana Tombach, and just give us a general idea of what, first of all, why whitebark pines are important enough to have their own ecosystem foundation.
Right. Well, whitebark pine actually is the largest, it has the largest range of any of our white pines in North America. And the range goes from the Southern Sierra clear up to north of Smithers, Canada. So it is found across a number of different mountain ranges, a number of different ecosystem types. But despite this large range, it's restricted to a very narrow elevation distribution. It's only found in the upper subalpine and at tree line. But there, it plays a very important ecological role. It is what we call a keystone species because its presence promotes biodiversity, and I'll explain that, if I may, in just a moment. And it's also considered a foundation species. Foundation species are key species that provide structure and stability to ecosystems, to communities. So a couple of the characteristics whitebark pine has that makes it so important. One, it produces very large nutritious seeds that wildlife really seek out. And these seeds are extremely sought after. And I will mention that this tree, unique to almost every North American tree, is dispersed by a bird, the Clark's Nutcracker. In other words, the tree has a co-evolved mutualism with a bird, which is a relative of crows, that's found at high elevations. And there is no other way that the seeds of this tree can get planted without the nutcracker. So that's a story unto itself that we could get back to. But I'll just mention, because of the bird, these seeds get planted in many different locations, and the tree, the seedlings, are very tolerant of stress and harsh conditions, so they can grow at the highest elevations. So why is whitebark important? One, it's very widespread. Two, it's tolerant of harsh conditions and can grow where other conifers cannot. And it, by doing this, it actually shades snowpack. It contributes to the water towers in terms of regulating downstream flow. Its canopies reduce the rate of snowmelt, so we have water coming down. If we have snowpack, of course, this area has its challenges, no doubt. But without whitebark, the challenges would be even worse. Thanks to the Clark's Nutcracker, if there's a major disturbance like mountain pine beetle or fire, the birds will bury the seeds in the soil, starting a new generation of whitebark pine very quickly after disturbance.
That's almost a symbiotic relationship.
Technically it's a mutualism. Mm-hmm. Symbiotic means living within each other in a way, sort of intertwined biologically. But yes, the dependence is symbiotic. I'll just point out that the bird doesn't depend on whitebark as much as whitebark depends on the bird. The bird will eat other seeds as well.
But it is just that one bird, that one distribution method for the seeds?
Absolutely. And whitebark pine is the only North American member of a group of pines called stone pines that are found in Europe and Asia. And they are similarly dispersed by the Eurasian nutcracker. So we suspect that the ancestor, both of the bird and the pine, came across the Bering Strait land bridge. And this makes whitebark unique, both evolutionarily, ecologically, but important for ecosystem services for us and forest biodiversity as well.
So Kristen Chadwick, the plant pathologist here, can talk about some of the challenges facing whitebark pines, I would presume. There are some issues with some things that are threatening the existence of them.
Yes, there's kind of four key issues. One is a non-native accidentally introduced fungus. It was introduced about a little over 100 years ago. white pine blister rust, or Carnarsia morbicula. It occurs in Oregon and Washington throughout the range of white bark, and appeared down here in southwest Oregon probably about in the 1930s. So its role is that it's threatening white bark because it can take out the regeneration, actually kill the small trees in the stands, and then it takes out the seed-producing overstory trees too by slowly girdling branches and causing top kill. And so it's changed the way white bark looks on the landscape throughout Oregon and Washington and throughout the range of white bark. White pine blister rust is still continuing its spread throughout the white bark pine distribution. It hasn't been found in all locations yet, but it definitely is playing a big role in how it regenerates and keeping white bark as a seed source and a food source for Clark's Nutcracker. Another threat is mountain pine beetle. We've just kind of wrapped up, for the most part, a mountain pine beetle epidemic throughout Oregon and Washington and even California. Over the last 10 years, we've seen huge changes in stand structures and losses of mortality from mountain pine beetle to white bark pine, and then also the lodgepole pine. I think people mostly notice the mortality in the lodgepole pine because we have so many more acres in lodgepole pine that you might tend to drive through as you're in the high Cascades. But it's definitely one of those species that is native. It has evolved in these forest systems, but we see huge losses that we're here to witness in this time frame. It's not that it hasn't been in white bark pine before. It definitely tends to intensify in areas in white bark pine where we have lodgepole pine located next adjacent to it or in mixed stands, and we've seen a lot of mortality. So now we're really looking towards that regeneration in the next stand that's coming up, and looking at how much blister rust is in there to see what's happening for the future of white bark in a lot of these stands. Another threat is definitely climate change, just because of the snow cover and suitable acreage for planting and regenerating white bark pine. And so we're definitely interested in that and following that through time to see how that follows and if we lose a lot of potential habitat for future plantings of white bark pine. The fourth key threat would be fire suppression activities. White bark pine is not a very good competitor with other tree species. So when we have other tree species on site, like subalpine fir and mountain hemlock in a lot of our stands, coming up underneath it, it outcompetes. They outcompete white bark pine, and we see the loss of habitat for white bark pine also. So as we've started fire suppression activities over the last 100 years in our high elevation stands, we've started to see the loss of suitable habitat for white bark pine too. And that's something that's unfortunately here to stay in a lot of cases, unless we can do some fire management activities.
All right, white bark pine, the discussion topic here on the Jefferson Exchange. Kristen Chadwick is a plant pathologist with the U.S. Forest Service. We also have Diana Tomback, the director of the White Bark Pine Ecosystem Foundation, and Jennifer Beck from Crater Lake National Park. You can join this discussion at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Jennifer, when you're talking about higher elevation areas, this would seem to include a great deal of the land within Crater Lake National Park. Do you have a fair scattering of white bark pine within the park?
We do. We tend to see it above 6,500 feet. And what's unique about Crater Lake National Park is that the white bark pine is typically considered a wilderness species because it is found on the tops of the highest peaks and the highest elevations. But we have very accessible white bark pine habitat with the Rim Drive that circles the Caldera Rim, many popular trails that go to the summits of our higher peaks, the Garfield Peak Trail, Mount Scott, Union Peak, Watchman Peak. So it's very easy to get to the park and to get into white bark pine habitat. So it's a place locally where we can all go and hike around and experience the trees and enjoy them.
You don't have to be a serious wilderness backpacker to see them in that area.
Right, but we do have about 43% of our total habitat in our recommended wilderness, so it's in the backcountry as well.
So, and what is the general state of white bark pines within Crater Lake National Park?
It is similar to what's going on throughout the range. As you know, it is now a candidate species for listing under the Endangered Species Act. We feel like we've lost about half of our historic acreage.
Mostly to blister rust, mostly to pine beetle, some combination?
Mountain pine beetle is our leading mortality agent that's come out in the last decade, but the white pine blister rust is definitely contributing as well.
And Does the fire suppression part of all this, though, that does figure in some of the challenge to white bark pine? It's been interesting to watch as we've watched the National Creek Complex burn. That the U.S. Forest Service land has been managed a little more intensively. The fire on Park Service land has been allowed to burn a little more anyway, it would appear.
Well, we just have had a lack of roads and trails to use as control lines. We have had to go and put in some direct fire line to control the south line. But for the total fire effects you've seen in the park have been really a mixed fire mosaic. And so there have been some good effects, some high-severity patches for sure. But overall, when you look, it looks nice.
I was going to say, it's the kind of mixture you actually want. You want to have that mosaic fire effect, right?
That's right. And it helps with the mountain pine beetle outbreaks by creating that heterogeneity and diversity across the landscape.
So then to come back to you, Diana Tombeck, I mean, what kinds of recommendations do you make at the White Bark Pine Ecosystem Foundation? You just go by WPEF. What's your short term for yourself?
Well, we call ourselves the WPEF as well. But let me tell you a little bit of the history, and then we can talk about where we're going with this. We are a group of volunteers. The foundation is 15 years old, and it started from interagency folks who were watching the decline of white bark pine. Most of us initially were from the Northern Rockies, and I have to say that the Northern Rockies are the white bark pine communities are nearly non-functional. They are much farther ahead, and we know what the unfortunately what the trajectory can look like as a result of working in Glacier National Park, the Bob Marshall Wilderness, Waterton Lakes, so basically southern Canada as well. They're also struggling with these same issues. I'll just mention that fire suppression actually is a bigger issue out where we are in the Northern Rockies, not so much around here. And so we see advanced succession. We see these shade-tolerant conifers overtopping white bark pine. Because of the absence of the historical fire regime, basically. Mm-hmm. All right, so where are we heading with this? There is hope. Even though blister rust is a tough nut to crack, there is no way to stop it in its tracks. So what we are looking for are trees that have some genetic resistance. And this is where Dorena Tree Improvement Center up in Cottage Grove comes in for this region. Under the direction of Rich Sinesco, they have been actually screening white bark pine parent trees for genetic resistance. So once these trees are identified, and by the way, this is about a 7-year laborious process, and the resources that this takes are fairly considerable. So the foundation is interested in supporting all these restoration efforts, including the identification of rust-resistant trees, harvesting the cones, getting seeds, growing seedlings. The most important thing we can do to keep white bark pine from extirpation is to plant blister rust-resistant seedlings. And then, of course, manage to some extent for mountain pine beetle, as Jen mentioned, keeping a mosaic on the landscape of different age classes of forests is the best way we can do that. We got ourselves into this present pickle because we had even-aged trees, all perhaps the result of major logging that took place in the late 19th and early 20th century. So the White Bark Pine Ecosystem Foundation's role and mission is basically to promote the restoration of white bark pine, but also to outreach and educate about the importance of the species. The fact is we work as partners with the U.S. Forest Service and the National Park Service and the mm-hmm. BLM and the other resource agencies helping to promote restoration, providing workshops each year as we have tomorrow for an opportunity for the latest information to be disseminated about restoration techniques. I'll also point out, in addition to planting blister rust seedlings, and by the way, we're acting like Clark's Nutcrackers by doing that, but we're a little smarter in that we're really selective in terms of what seedlings actually get out there. We're hastening natural selection. We're acting like selection and just putting the seedlings out that have the best chance of survival. But other techniques we use in other areas, including the Rockies, would be prescribed fire in order to get rid of the competitors or silvicultural thinning to get rid of the more shade-tolerant, faster-growing competitors of white bark pine.
Is prescribed fire in particular in the Rockies, since there have been some really devastating fires along the Rockies in the last few years, is it a hard case to make for prescribed fire, or are you able to make the case that we burn a little now or we burn a lot later?
That's a very excellent point. On the other hand, people who actually oversee the prescribed fire are extremely careful about monitoring humidity levels, climate conditions. So, for example, they tend to do this now in the fall, timed with the first frost. They really want to make sure that fires don't go beyond where they intended them to go. I would say the bottom line really is all these techniques are important for giving white bark pine a chance, but the outplanting of rust-resistant seedlings is the highest on our list in terms of importance. Blister rust is not going to go away. Crenartium rubicola has spread, by the way, to other five-needle white pines. White bark pine has relatives such as limber pine, foxtail pine, and you have foxtail pine in this area. And then there's Great Basin bristlecone pine, the long-lived species, very susceptible. We're worried that blister rust could, in fact, infect these ancient trees, very picturesque. We have Rocky Mountain bristlecone, a different species. All these are highly vulnerable, and all except Great Basin bristlecone pine are infected to some extent by blister rust, and they've been hit by mountain pine beetle. So it's really all these pines that white bark is the poster child umbrella for, and unfortunately, it's been hit the hardest. Let me just point out that blister rust is throughout the range of white bark, with the exception of some populations in the Great Basin. And so it is, in effect, nearly range-wide. The Cascades of Oregon, particularly the Sierra of California, are kind of the last places where blister rust is spreading into white bark. It's been there in sugar pine and western white, but now it's really ramping up in white bark pine.
All right, white bark pine is our discussion topic here in the Jefferson Exchange. We'll take a couple more minutes with Diana Tomback, who's the director of the White Bark Pine Ecosystem Foundation. Kristen Chadwick is a plant pathologist with the U.S. Forest Service, and Jennifer Beck works at Crater Lake National Park. Have humans had a part in the spread of blister rust in particular, Jen Chadwick?
It was actually brought over as accidentally from trying to breed or bring in western white pine. So it's a host, all five needle pines, western white pine, sugar pine are hosts. So about 1910, it was introduced in seedlings that were shipped over. It was introduced in both the East Coast and the West Coast within the same time frame. And then rapidly spread. It has a very complex life cycle, which makes it interesting. It alternates to ribes primarily, and then also to other high elevation species, Castilleia, Indian paintbrush, and pedicularis as alternate hosts. So in order for it to complete its life cycle, it has to cycle through the other hosts. We have done our best efforts throughout time and back in the CCC days of trying to do ribes eradication. Back then, everybody was really interested more in the western white pine component because of it being a high economic timber value species. Now we're looking at what those players look like in those high elevation systems. It seems like it can spread by spores very long distances for one of the spore stages. The rest of them are fairly fragile. So it seems like it's still spreading long distances, mostly on its own, when we have the right climatic conditions. There's some ideas that it probably jumped somewhere from the Sierras into New Mexico, finally discovered in, I think, 2010, but they think that the infection happened in the 1970s based on some climate data. So we're not really, it's not like some of your other diseases that you're probably familiar with in this area where we're spreading up via vehicle wash stations like
Phytophthora lateralis.
Right. Or Phytophthora lateralis. At this point, it's probably throughout the range, and it's going to be in areas due to the right climatic conditions. It's not something that we can take a proactive approach about in having people wash cars or not spread plant material. Not spreading plant material is also very important, too, for many other reasons. So it's throughout the range, but I think it's something that understanding the dynamics and high elevation systems we're really starting to get a hold on, because I think in some of these areas you're hard pressed to find ribes as an alternate host, but if you start looking just downstream in the local drainages, those spores are spread upslope pretty easily at the right time of year via cloud banks.
Okay, just got 2 minutes left here, and I want to ask about the major thrust here, which is to try to plant resistant species, which sounds, Diana Tombeck, like a really fantastically complicated process, because you're talking about getting trees in high elevations in remote areas.
Right, and that actually is a great segue here. Close to 49% of whitebark pine is in wilderness area, and at this point in time, we really can't plant so in those areas, and we're going to have to really rethink strategies. One reason about that is that, just to follow up for a moment on what we just talked about, the causes of the decline in whitebark pine are mostly human-generated. They're anthropogenic. And it's not just bringing blister rust in. It's the warming temperatures that are associated with climate change that have fueled the mountain pine beetle outbreaks, plus suppressing fire. So we have even-age stands of hosts. And so really humans are the cause of this decline in whitebark pine. So we really feel that we bear a responsibility. So resources are obviously needed for this outplanting. There are ways of getting seedlings into backcountry using horses. Obviously, we prefer roads if we can drive in. But right now, we have a lot of determined folks, range-wide and whitebark, who are starting to think about this outplanting. And lots of projects have been carried out already in the Northern Rockies.
And a lot of the folks who are concerned are gathering this weekend again in Ashland for the Whitebark Pine Ecosystem Foundation Annual Science and Management Workshop going on through the weekend at Southern Oregon University. Diana Tombeck is the director of the Whitebark Pine Ecosystem Foundation. Jennifer Beck is with Crater Lake National Park. And Kristen Chadwick is a plant pathologist with the U.S. Forest Service. Thank you all for joining us this morning on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having us.